It is why we continue today. And now, as for you, continue in what you have learned and have become convinced of, because you know those from whom you learned it, and how from infancy you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. For six generations, the Schaefer family has worshipped at this same Evangelical Lutheran Church in Lawler, Iowa. For six generations, they have farmed the land in the area, and for six generations, they have helped the immaculate structure retain its austere beauty. We did $55,000 in restoration work to the steeple and bell tower, plus a new handicapped entrance to the basement, all paid by donations by the time the projects were completed, says Schaefer. Since I am a trustee of the church, I headed up the projects. In my spare time, he deadpans. Schaefer is not a man who has much downtime, let alone spare time. My father's family grew up in central Iowa, so he moved up here with his parents, and then my parents met. My mom still lives on the farm yet. I was dairy farming up until last year and sold our dairy cows. But the last 16 years, I've worked for the Soil and Water Conservation District as an environmental specialist in watershed projects. Schaefer has lived in Howard County all of his life, halfway between the small towns of Lawler and Cresco. The only time he came close to leaving was right after high school. My plan was to go to the military. Growing up, I had several uncles who fought in World War II and grew up listening to war stories in the South Pacific, and had one uncle that landed in Normandy. My idea was I was going to the military and then to college for 4 years. But it was right in the midst of the farm crisis, mid-80s. The only thing that made us money was the dairy. My dad was 62 at the time. His voice trails off as he explains his father's age, factoring into his decision to stay and help. The 1980s brought the American farmer to his knees. The crisis was a convergence of events. Two major droughts, years of monstrous accumulated debt, and the roller coaster uncertainty of commodity prices that resulted in hundreds of family farms collapsing almost daily. By the end of the decade, nearly 300,000 farmers defaulted on their loans, and more banks failed in 1985 than in all the years since the Great Depression. The impact was devastating. It was the beginning of the end of many rural main streets across America, especially in Iowa. Farmers and their families no longer had incomes to spend on local goods, either because their money was scarce or they had literally lost the farm. White crosses dotted abandoned farmsteads, emotional and stark reminders left by the owners that they had fallen victim to the financial circumstances of the decade. It was a time of great instability in the heartland, and many of those scars still have not begun to heal. Even today, a generation later, Iowa has 65 counties with fewer than 20,000 people, and only six with more than 100,000. Small-town Iowa is Iowa. Schaefer watched everything sink around him and understood he was needed on the farm. If they would have sold that, we had huge debt, and I don't think we could have made it without the dairy cows. I thought, well, I'll milk cows for a few years. Then we got the bank paid off, and it was kind of nice. You got to keep the whole milk check. Then my folks got older, and then, well, I just love what I do now. I work with farmers every day, and I'm working to improve the environment. Schaefer works for the Howard County Soil and Water Conservation District. I am a watershed project coordinator. I work to improve water quality on a tributary of the Upper Iowa River called Silver Creek, he explains. As a solid, rock-ribbed conservative, he chuckles at the notion that conservatives do not want to protect the environment. I mean, we are called conservatives. We want to conserve the environment, and as someone whose faith is very important to their lives, I am tasked to be a good steward of the earth, he says of his evangelical beliefs. The funding for his job comes from the EPA, the money funneled to Iowa's Department of Natural Resources, then on to his local soil and water conservation district. In essence, I use EPA funds to cost-share projects for local farmers like manure puts, grasses, waterway and wetland restoration. Schaefer is one of six children, and family and faith have always been the driving force in his life. We are a very close-knit family. You talk about family dinners. Every Sunday, we went to either an aunt's house or uncle's, or they were at our house. I think there was more sense of community when families got together a lot more. It's kind of a distant thing now. The next generation's very busy. You don't see that connection, he says, sighing. Growing up, I mean, we went to church every Sunday together, too. Faith is still a very important part of my life. In 2008, Barack Obama won 62% of the vote over John McCain here in tiny Howard County, one of Iowa's smallest. Obama's support didn't budge much in 2012 when the president won 59% of the county's vote, defeating Mitt Romney. 4 years later, Trump won 58% of the traditionally Democratic county's vote, a feat that would not have been possible without rock-solid support among evangelicals for the thrice-married philanderer and regular guest on the racy Howard Stern radio show. Exit polls conducted for national news networks showed that Trump beat Clinton 80% to 16% among self-identifying evangelical or born-again white voters, including a 70% to 25% margin in Iowa. That national margin was better than the 78 to 21 advantage Mitt Romney mustered among white evangelicals in 2012. Romney's Mormon faith was theologically alien to many evangelicals, but his devoutness and personal comportment should have made him a better match than Trump. Howard County's 42-point swing in margin from 2012 to 2016 made it the third most volatile county in the entire country, trailing only Clark County, Missouri, and Elliott County, Kentucky. Overall, 32 Iowa counties switched party allegiances from 2012 to 2016, more than in any other state in the country. The swing in votes in Howard is notable because it's a county that doesn't really have an active, official Republican Party apparatus. As that term is traditionally understood, the one it does have is run by Schaefer, who says they are often left to their own devices by the state party. We have been kind of an independent organization for 20 years. We can't rely on our state, national, or our state party. I couldn't even get a Romney sign. I had to go down to the sign shop and have them make us one so we had one for our fair booth. That's how disorganized they were, he says. Sitting in the meeting room of the Howard County Farm Bureau on First Avenue, Schaefer, at 50, has sandy brown hair, glasses, an infectious smile, and the calm, deliberate voice of someone who spends his time educating people. This room is typically reserved for meetings about conservation issues important to this farming community, from how to best protect water quality to field practices such as restoring wetlands and using the bioreactors that play a crucial role in Iowa farming. Conservation talks, events, webinars, lectures, and hands-on advice from ag experts fill up a big part of the yearly calendar on the wall. There are also reminders for the Farm Service Agency crop certification deadline and the mighty Howard County Fair in June, and when the baby pigs and cows will be at the fair. Schaefer says that politics was always part of his family's discussion. Always has been. Always has been. My parents were staunch Republicans. My dad passed away about 13 years ago from cancer. They both grew up in, well, actually, Dad's family were FDR Democrats, but my mother's family were out there for Alf Landon in that. He says of the obscure Republican Kansas governor who ran against FDR in 1936 and went down in the greatest electoral landslide since the beginning of the current two-party system in the 1850s. Roosevelt beat Landon in every state except Maine and Vermont, and won 523 electoral votes. Yeah, they were pretty die-hard Republican. My folks always voted. I remember we had a little one-room schoolhouse down the road, and they'd go vote, come back, and we'd always watch the election returns. The first election I remember is the Republican convention, and I was watching Ford and Reagan. My folks were actually Reagan fans back in 1976. The first election I voted in, I just missed getting to vote for Reagan that year. We had a picture of Reagan hanging on our wall. Catholic families had JFK on the wall. We had Reagan, he says. Most of my friends are Catholic. This community is probably 60% Roman Catholic and probably 30% Lutheran, then 10% Methodist, others. But faith has always been something. Even my friends now, most of them are pretty good churchgoers, he says. The political alliance between socially conservative Catholics and socially conservative Protestant evangelicals has always been intermittent, with many Catholics voting their blue-collar economic outlook as often as their views on abortion. But the convergence of those two factors in the Trump coalition has big ramifications in Iowa. The congressman representing Howard County is second-termer Rod Blum, a Dubuque software entrepreneur who first won election in 2014, breaking an 8-year Democratic grip on the Northeast Iowa district, and was then easily re-elected by 8 points in 2016, in spite of heavy targeting by national Democrats. The community in Howard County and all of northern and eastern Iowa has changed. And agriculture has changed since the late 1970s, becoming more consolidated. When I was a kid, there was a farm every 160 acres. They were diversified. They had pigs, cattle, milk, cows, chickens. One of my things was to collect eggs. We sold eggs. The egg truck came around and picked up eggs at farms. There was probably 300 or 400 dairies even up until the 70s. Now agriculture's gotten much bigger. The sense of community out of the rural areas is fading. Why? There are so few family farms left. They were mostly corporate. I would say half of the farmsteads have been leveled in just the last 20 years. Farms just got bigger. Commodity prices kind of drove a lot of that. And for me, 160 acres, milking 40 cows, you couldn't make a living at that. That's why I went into town and started working with the conservation groups. So the family sold off all of their dairy cows. My mother still owns all of the land. It's the family farm. She's the matriarch of the farming establishment. So now we just raise corn and soybeans. We just have a custom hire done. It's too expensive to try and do it on your own. The investment of what it costs to put in a crop is just unbelievable. I paid $15,000 for corn and soybean seed. And some years, if we got $8,000 or $9,000 for our soybean crop, we were lucky. It's big stakes now. You're investing $400 to $500 an acre into your crops. And tight margins. Last year, farmers, if they made $50 an acre on their crop, they were looking good. Things are getting very tight. The last 2 years, most of the ag in our area survived because we had outstanding yields, because our prices have dropped so much. This year, we're starting to wonder. We haven't had the best ideal planting season. There's a lot of nervous people out there. There's nervous people in the banking industry, he says. For Schaefer, 8 years under Barack Obama's policies felt like prison. I've worked within government. I could see how things were changing and how the environmental extremists' view was coming into our daily actions and process, making things much more difficult to get something done. I also felt from the first get-go of Obama was that the country's sliding backwards. Government interference, just, I almost want to say, a moral decay. This attitude of entitlement for people seemed to be getting worse and worse every year. The direction of the country really has me concerned. It was one of the driving forces for me in this election. Liberty, especially religious liberty, was always under attack. I felt like there was no one to protect people who held traditional values. It was really all very backwards. You cannot force people to do things that go against the fundamentals of their religion as long as it is not illegal. That is just not what we are in this country. And yet, that is exactly what we started to become. I also think there is such an elitist attitude and a smugness. Well, that's not how we are here. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican or Catholic or Lutheran, we're an extended family, and we wouldn't treat people like that. It just had that attitude, especially toward the Midwest. Schaefer's first choice was not Donald Trump. "Oh, no, it was Ben Carson," he says. "I have been tired for years of the party bosses telling us we have to give the next person in line the nomination. They did that to us with John McCain and Mitt Romney, and this time I had had enough. I wanted someone who would actually stand up for us, protect our liberties." Like many Iowans, showered with attention from presidential wannabes eager to impress in the state whose caucuses kick off the nominating process every 4 years, Schaefer can rattle off minute details about his feelings toward almost everyone who ran in 2016. When Trump entered, he was uneasy. "I was a very big skeptic. I was just not into him. I tried to somewhat be a bit neutral, because I'm the chair of the county party, but I started out, I was a big Ben Carson fan. I was for Carson, but I was like, he just doesn't have the drive. He's a nice guy, I love what he says, but he just don't have the fire. Then I jumped to Rand Paul. I like his dad. We've had these straw poll votes in Iowa, and I would always end up voting for his dad, because I just love the enthusiasm. I have a bit of a libertarian streak to me," he says. "Well, after I went to Rand Paul, then I thought, he's not doing anything. He's not even a person. Then I really got on to Marco Rubio. A good friend of mine, young guy, was so enthusiastic. I thought, man, I'm going to get involved there. That's who I actually caucused for, was Marco Rubio. Then the wheels pretty much fell off his bus, too. I didn't like how he seemed petty, just unpolished. I thought, well, I'll have to give him a few more years. Then I was really kind of in limbo. They're all dropping out, and I am left with Trump." He pauses, rolls his eyes, and then breaks out into a wide grin. Then you hear, "Oh, we can't be for him, the way he talks and everything." Then, what really changed it for me was when he came out with that list of Supreme Court nominees. Then it was over. All over. I was in. Schaefer says of Trump's gambit to consolidate conservative votes as the GOP nomination process wound down in May 2016. He released a list of judges he'd use, if elected, to pick the replacement for Justice Antonin Scalia. "Right then, I said, I don't care what you think of the man, I don't care what he said. If all he does is put one, then I'll be for it. From that point, that's what I always told people." Trump's gambit worked, and not just to get Schaefer. By the end of May, Trump had secured the endorsement of the Supreme Court-minded National Rifle Association, which would go on to spend tens of millions on his behalf in the election and become his biggest ally. Separate from any formal group, Trump had also created a rallying cry for evangelical voters across the country who had been put off by his bawdy language and rough Manhattan ways. It was an awakening for Schaefer. "All of a sudden, I started seeing people who were lifelong Democrats talking about how they were not going to vote for Hillary." For these voters, spooked by a decade of court cases, such as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that a high school football coach, Joseph Kennedy, had no First Amendment right to kneel and briefly pray at the 50-yard line after a football game, one of many rulings that drew ever thicker lines around the extent to which religious beliefs may be used as a constitutional defense against the majority's secular priorities. There suddenly was a tangible and seemingly achievable transaction justifying a vote for Trump. 5 months later, when a tape was made public of Trump on a hot mic backstage, speaking in the most vulgar terms about his attempts at adultery, plenty of evangelicals stuck with him. Republican pollster Wes Anderson of On Message, Inc., in his post-election survey of 8 presidential target states, found that 52% of Trump's voters cited the Supreme Court vacancy as an extremely important factor in deciding their vote, compared to 43% of Clinton voters who assigned it such importance. Both are large numbers for a single issue, but the intensity clearly favored Trump. Trump, for his part, held up his end of the bargain by nominating appellate court judge Neil Gorsuch to fill the Supreme Court seat left vacant by Scalia. Gorsuch was not only a judge who'd been on the initial list that won Schaefer over to Trump, he was also a judge who had ruled in favor of the evangelical-owned Hobby Lobby chain of retail stores in its bid to seek a religious liberty exemption from the contraception coverage mandates in Obama's health care law. The precision of the political payback was not lost on evangelicals. Schaefer says that as long as Trump continues to have a positive impact on the courts, his support is not going anywhere. And I am pretty sure I am not alone. I don't think that institutional America understands how much we have split from them. And the courts and the protection of religious liberty is a big part of that. The amount of people I saw and talked to who never voted before and who are thrilled with him is a nuance they did not get. I'm an election precinct official, so I work election days. That election day in 2016, we probably had 127 people who came in to register to vote. We have same-day voting in Iowa. These people were from 18 years old to, I think, the oldest one was 80 years old. They were people who hadn't voted for 30, 40 years. They show up in our book as inactive. It was those people. You could just tell. They were there because they wanted to vote for someone. And they have not changed that sentiment. This is a very traditional community. We were looking for a warrior for us. I was so excited to vote for Trump by the time we got into October that we have early voting here. My mom and I, we voted. I'm sure I voted as soon as you could request a ballot. We voted. I never do that. I'm kind of traditional, and I work elections. I was going to work that day. I wanted to vote so badly for him, he says. I cannot emphasize this enough because I really, really did not want to vote for him. This was a big turnaround. I came a huge long way because even up until I saw that list of the Supreme Court judges, I was dreading what the summer was going to bring. Then I was, wait a minute, this is going to fire up people. We also have a community of people that are, I would say I'm a moderate libertarian streak to me, but we do have some pretty conservative Republicans. Bless their hearts, but they always seem to pick the losing candidate. Then they have sour grapes. At the end of the season, they just don't vote because they are so fed up and feel disenchanted. I ran into a couple of them, and they were getting Trump signs. It's like, what happened? You would think that Trump would be about the most opposite of them, but they saw that Supreme Court and knew what that was. Schaefer has always been a big fan of watching the Supreme Court. I felt like Obama put a bunch of mediocre people in, and Clinton, too. He put mediocre people in there. I'd much rather have Thurgood Marshall and Brennan on there than Sotomayor or Kagan. They're no large figures. I'd rather have a super liberal thundering person, but I also want a thundering Republican conservative. And Bush let us down. Souter, oh my God, Souter, even to an extent Kennedy. And Roberts, that was probably one of the biggest letdowns. That's when I saw the list and who was on that list. You didn't see any John Robertses or Anthony Kennedys or Souters. With two more justices in their 80s, Gorsuch may not be the last of Trump's appointees, a prospect that excites Schaefer. Support for Trump is only getting stronger. The way you see Trump treated now, I'm more on his side. I wasn't. I was pretty lukewarm, even going into the fall until that. The political class on both sides of the aisle and the media have shown their true colors, he says. It just makes me like him more. It is as simple as that. When Obama came along and he started this culture change, this is how you have to act. This is how you have to think. Everyone has to think his way or it is unacceptable. My whole idea growing up was free speech. Freedom of expression was you just can't scream fire in a crowded theater. When they start saying from the pulpit, your pastors or your priests can't say certain things, that's not America. That's something they've created out of this culture of acceptance, and you're a bigot if you don't accept everything the way I am. There's moral standards, and there's a line that you can walk, but also it is that you can't force it down people's throats. We just felt for the last 8 years we were spoon-fed this liberal cultural crap. It's nice, Schaefer says, to have a president that has the country's back and not apologizing for every imagined slight. Chapter 8. Silent Suburban Moms. If any group in the ultimate Donald Trump coalition was unexpected, it was the group of suburban women who stuck with him after a year's worth of campaigning designed to cleave them away from the Republican column. With Hillary Clinton seeking to break the glass ceiling and become the first female president, and a boorish septuagenarian billionaire on the other ticket, it would have seemed only natural that the 2016 election would see a gender gap far larger than normal, with women siding with the Democratic Party in even greater numbers. Except that's not what happened. From Clinton's first day on the national stage as a fresh college graduate who gave a widely noted commencement address at Wellesley College, to her tenure as a globally respected Secretary of State, she was seen as the poster image of the women's movement, the paragon of the barrier-breaking generation. Her second campaign for president ran on that premise exactly, targeting women in both parties with explicitly gender-based appeals. On the attack, her campaign's targets were educated Republicans and independents in the suburbs, whose sensibilities were offended by Trump's coarse manner and impulsive, often inappropriate rhetoric. Clinton's strategy worked to a point, but not nearly well enough to secure her the presidency. While Trump's margin among college-educated white women was below the Republican norm, those defections were not enough to deny him the electoral votes of every swing state in the Great Lakes region, plus Florida and North Carolina. Because she and her campaign team bet their entire strategy on this group and failed to get the margin they needed, the silent suburban mom is an important archetype in the Trump coalition. Younger than most of the coalition, less religiously conservative, one out of four in this group reported they had voted for Obama in either 2008 or 2012, according to the Great Revolt survey of Trump voters in the Great Lakes swing states. Almost half of them were uncomfortable telling friends they were voting for Trump during the campaign because they feared disapproval. They're less pro-life than the rest of the Trump coalition, but only slightly so. They are also less likely to cite the Supreme Court as a critical factor in their vote for Trump. As long as Trump is the face of the emerging populist conservative coalition, this group will remain on its margins and at the center of the electoral combat between the two parties. Cindy Sacco, Washington Township, Macomb County, Michigan. 28 miles separates the life Cindy Sacco and her husband once had in the city of Detroit proper and the one she has now in Washington Township, Michigan, located on the northwest tip of Macomb County. years after growing up along the famed 7 Mile Road as the daughter of a Detroit City police officer, working at her grandmother's lunch counter, and ultimately owning the lunch counter with her husband Bob, she still considers herself a Detroiter. For her, it's an identity that transcends an address. You sometimes hear that identity in the music of the famous artists born in the county, from Kid Rock to Eminem to Uncle Cracker. Halfway between home and the diner is 8 Mile Road, the not-invisible dividing line celebrated and lamented in popular music that has long served as a psychological, cultural, economic, and racial border between the urban core of the predominantly black city and the whiter, middle-to-upper-class suburbanites who escaped the city's decay. The farther north you travel in Macomb County, away from 8 Mile Road, the post-World War II blue-collar suburbs slowly give way to more affluent suburbs and newer, trendier housing stock. With a population of 867,730, Macomb is no longer one homogeneous place, but the bonds between the county's north and south, both culturally and politically, remain strong. Unlike in suburban enclaves in other parts of the country, people in Washington Township rarely identify themselves as anything other than someone from Detroit. Perhaps one of the most uniquely misunderstood aspects of this region's racial tension is the nostalgia that both blacks and whites have for old Detroit. "I will always be that girl from East Detroit," says Sacco of the Macomb suburb closest to the city. Her current home, farther north, is lovely, the third one she and her husband have bought since migrating here in the 1970s. Located in the pristine suburbs of northwest Macomb, they are a stone's throw from their working-class roots, but on the cusp of the exurbs. This is prime real estate, once the home of orchards filled with apples, cornfields, and berry farms. It is now home to successful suburbanites, nearly all with blue-collar roots, who made it out of the city in the 1970s on more than just sheer willpower. They worked two jobs. They worked overtime. They took out loans. In short, they did everything they legally could to move out and up. Macomb sits perpendicularly across two trends that run concurrently in most other American suburbs. It is much more affluent than the national average, but also less educated. Mid-decade census estimates show that only 23% of the county has a college degree. The national average is nearly 30%. But the annual median household income is $55,931, 10% above the statewide median in Michigan. For decades, both those figures were driven by good union jobs in the auto industry. The ideal of physical labor producing a solid and reliable middle-class lifestyle is part of the place's identity, and Sacco's. "We busted our behinds," she says. "Everything you see here, we worked very hard for," Sacco says of her immaculate Macomb home, filled with original artwork, custom window treatments, and an elegant mix of traditional and antique furnishings. The community where her home is located is also exceptional. Stony Creek Metro Park surrounds it. So do two golf courses. A pristine white octagonal cupola sits on top of this house, designed in the mid-2000s in the early American Federalist tradition. Time has treated Sacco well. At 66, her deep chestnut hair is thick and frames her broad, warm face attractively. She is gracious, pragmatic, and directly to the point, like many Midwesterners of her generation. She is the exact voter nearly every pollster in America misunderstood in the 2016 presidential election, a suburban woman of Hillary Clinton's generation. Pollsters assume Trump's crass conduct with women would hurt him with these female voters. It did, but not enough to give the slim margin of victory to Clinton. Exit polls show that 53% of white women voted for Trump, including more independent-minded suburban voters like Sacco, than almost any pre-election survey projected. She was one of those voters hiding in plain sight, unwilling, as she says, to be unheard in the voting booth. Until her recent retirement, she was a card-carrying member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union, AFSCME, and drove a school bus. Her dream as a young woman was to finish college and become an art teacher, but before she could finish, she and her husband got the opportunity to purchase the B&M, the family lunch counter named after her grandparents, Bob and Mary, who owned it in Detroit's heyday. When we were first married, we took over my grandmother's lunch counter along East 7 Mile in Detroit. We ran it together for 5 years until I found out I was pregnant with twins, then we sold it, Sacco says. 3 years and three kids later, they got a call from the city of Detroit. The new owner had failed to pay the taxes, the water bill, and the electricity. Because the sale had been a land contract sale, a quirky arrangement that allowed homeowners and businesses to sell homes and businesses no one wanted to buy when the neighborhood started collapsing, the business came back to Cindy and Bob. It was a pattern that repeated for the Saccos 3 times. In the longest stretch during which the business was theirs, from 1980 to 1985, Cindy ran the restaurant, commuting every day back and forth between the suburbs and East 7 Mile, while Bob got the children off to school. He was in law school then, so he would get the kids ready and drive the nearly 100 miles to law school in Lansing. And I would be home right after they got home from school, she says. The diner was only open until 4 p.m. Every time they got the business back, it was in worse condition, surrounded by a neighborhood that had deteriorated a little more. After a series of robberies on their last tenure of ownership, Cindy had had enough. So had Bob. I was worried about her constantly, he says, sitting across from her in their sunroom. They boarded the diner up and eventually sold it in 1985 to a man named Alvin Taylor, who still operates it today as Taylor Made Burgers. Cindy explains that she took the job as the school bus driver when her husband first started out as an attorney because he had no benefits. She kept that job, even after Bob began to achieve personal success, because she loved it. And I was able to be home with the kids when they were home. I had the same days off they did. It was the perfect balance. And I enjoyed it, which is why I never quit. I loved driving the kids. I loved getting them safely to and from school. I enjoyed talking to the parents, she says. Sacco grew up in a Democratic family in a Democratic city, worked for a union that lived and breathed Democratic politics. She spent most of her adult life voting mostly Democrat, but that started to change as she got older. Then I just flipped back and forth. Safety and security were big issues for me, so I would vote the person, especially locally. Safety and security are still at the top of her list when it comes time to vote. I do not think that people understood there are many suburban women who vote based on who makes them believe they will keep them, their children, their grandchildren, and their communities safe, she says. People laugh if you say you worry about a terror attack happening again, like September 11th. Their argument is that level of attack would never happen in Michigan. And I wonder why they don't understand that September 11th had a very emotional impact for people living hundreds of miles away from Ground Zero, Sacco says. Our countrymen and women perished there doing nothing more than going to their jobs on a Tuesday morning. They are part of the fabric of the entire country. That is a real pain, to see that happen to people in our country. I am concerned for all of us, and I think that we had been weak and too politically correct during the Obama administration, she says. The same goes for self-defense. I want someone in office that will protect my right to bear arms, and protect the fundamentals of the Second Amendment. Longtime Macomb County Republican campaign operative Jamie Rowe says that cultural connection on gut-level issues is what put Trump in position to snap the GOP's drought in Michigan. "They thought this guy had their back," he said in a telephone interview. "Those people who were tired of having the liberal establishment look down their noses at them, when they saw the establishment and the media attack Trump, it made him stronger." But perhaps showing that even Macomb is subject to some of the same social pressures that other suburbs its size experience, Sacco says she rarely told anyone that she was voting for Trump in the fall of 2016. "The general understanding among people who either did not like him or do not know anyone who has lived in a place like Macomb County was his conduct and comments would eliminate him from consideration by women," she says. "That is fine, I suppose. What they do not understand is that women are more worried about the economy than they are about his crass delivery of words. Even if your life is going well, you worry about it for your children. You worry that you could be one deep recession or economic downturn from losing what you worked so hard for." Among men, Rowe thinks Trump's unorthodox and edgy, even offensive, communication style was a big part of his appeal to the group of voters that can swing to either party in Macomb County. "The guy has been around construction sites his entire life, and he has respected the work those guys did," Rowe says. "The blunt way he talks connected with them." Trump made three campaign stops in Macomb County in the run-up to the 2016 election and carried most of its communities on Election Day. In Washington Township, where Sacco lives, Trump won in a landslide in all 10 precincts, defeating Clinton 67.1% to 27.4%. Trump won the county overall by 12 points after Barack Obama had beaten John McCain by 16 points here and Mitt Romney by 4. Trump's 54% was the best presidential showing by a Republican in Macomb in 28 years. More stinging for Democrats, Trump's winning margin in Macomb of 48,348 votes was good enough to swing the entire state with its 16 electoral votes by a margin of 10,704. Clinton didn't even need anything like Obama's 2012 Macomb County margin of 16,103 to win the state. She just needed to not lose it big. Trump's three visits to Macomb County were not unique. Bill Clinton came three times in 1992, and his opponent, incumbent President George H.W. Bush, came twice. Hillary Clinton came to Macomb County, too, to give a job speech at a community college, but not until after a Detroit News statewide poll had found her trailing in the county in early August. She made another last-ditch trip to Detroit proper in the campaign's closing days. "Macomb County is full of ticket splitters. They will vote for the people who split the ticket, the person they think will do the best job, whether it's local, whether it's state legislator, whether it's federal," explained Sacco. Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg, who served as one of Bill Clinton's top advisors, has been a longtime student and chronicler of Macomb County's evolving politics. In his book, Middle Class Dreams, Greenberg recalls being hired by local Democratic leaders in 1985 to study the group of people now made famous as Reagan Democrats, longtime blue-collar party loyalists who had twice broken ranks to support a Republican for president, with Macomb County considered the epicenter of a broader national movement. Greenberg's book was written in 1995, a decade after his initial research, but it could have just as easily been written about the Trump voter. Recalling his earliest Macomb focus groups of Reagan voters, Greenberg described their animus to both parties. The Republicans thought mainly about big business, and the Democrats concentrated mainly on the minority groups. These workers saw themselves as members of a new minority class that was ignored by the government but forced to support social programs that did not benefit them. Greenberg now believes Trump has made a major mistake by allying with Paul Ryan's attempts to roll back the Affordable Care Act, and that attacks on Republicans for trying to cut Medicaid will be potent in the midterms. A thread through all of Greenberg's McComb research, including a post-election study he did for Democracy Corps in 2017, is that the swing voter in this part of the Rust Belt is not averse to government on philosophical grounds and is keenly sensitive to appeals to both patriotism and strength. In 1995, Greenberg wrote, "Ronald Reagan sided with the small against the big. He was seen to be waging a sincere and determined struggle against big and inexorable forces." Sacco saw the same in Trump as early as the first Republican primary debate in 2015. "I loved the slogan, 'Make America Great Again.' And second, he was not going to bend and bow to political correctness." Those were probably the first two things, Sacco says. Third thing, he was a very successful, independent-minded person who did not need to run for president, but did, out of his, I feel, dedication and debt to the greatness of the nation. He saw it. He stood out. He wasn't afraid to say what everybody was thinking. Truth is very appealing. Greenberg noted that the populist resentment in McComb extended beyond big government. They identified with things small and suspected big and powerful institutions of any kind, labor and business, government, and both political parties. Today, sitting in her suburban McComb home, Sacco says detachment extends now to big media outlets, whose personalities she perceives to be culturally disconnected from her worldview. "Here is what I do not understand. Why do they shun people who have faith, who believe in God? And I don't think that's fair. That's not right. I don't go around picking on people who don't have faith and try to degrade them. So I wish they wouldn't do that," she says. As attested by Greenberg's borderline obsessive writings about McComb, President Clinton reportedly would teasingly ask his pollster if the county had more electoral votes than Florida. The populism that McComb has embodied in the American political lexicon is not a new phenomenon, but a lasting one. Sacco, for one, sees herself as part of something that will outlast the election that put the place back in the spotlight. "What I feel isn't an anomaly. This movement unequivocally goes on long past Trump, and this is going to be a continuing battle. This fascinating group of people who placed him in the White House is because a variety of different people wanted to be part of something bigger than themselves," she says. "It means it makes me more important. It makes the individual more important, believing that they are contributing directly or indirectly in whatever they're doing." Sacco is not someone to sit still. She now volunteers 3 days a week at a senior center. "I just love working with the seniors. I lost my mom 5 years ago, and I was still driving the bus at the time, and I started to think it's probably time to do something else." And so she did. "There are 250 residents, and I know everybody's name," she says, becoming animated. She clearly loves what she does. It connects her to the mother she lost and the grandmother whose lunch counter she and her husband bought. They do Zumba and chair Zumba, chair dancing, because some of them can't stand up. Line dancing, they do it in the chair. I run bingo 3 times a week. We serve a lot of liquor. Cocktail party, wine and cheese," she says, laughing. The voters of Macomb County have been volatile over the last 3 decades, switching from lifetimes of Democratic allegiance to Reagan, to Bill Clinton and Obama, and then back to Trump. But if Sacco is representative, Republicans now may have a chance to solidify the county in this new conservative populist fusion in the wake of a decades-long leftward Democratic drift. "You know, I personally will never turn back. I don't agree with what every conservative or Republican or independent thinks, and I haven't always liked the way that Trump has talked. But I think the importance of his list of Supreme Court nominees was and is so huge going forward that I cannot imagine that not being the driving force on my support going forward, she says. Sacco has been a first-hand witness to the essential core of the U.S. economy changing. No place in America has been as rocked by the twin forces of automation and importation as has Detroit, leaving corroding factories, demolished homes, and human displacement. For people like Sacco, who have made their lives in Macomb County, the personal cost was always right in front of them. The sorrow of those changes are everywhere, she says. We are tired of these disturbances marginalizing American workers that have scraped out of their hometowns and either scattered away from families or left trying to recreate something that is gone. No one has guided us through this ruthless transition. Trump identified what we already knew. This time, though, something different happened. We banded together. It's going to take a lot to extricate that. Patty Bloomstein, Frontier, Erie County, Pennsylvania. Due west from the clutter of fast food restaurants, cottages, and budget motels concentrated around the entrance to Presque Isle State Park, a picturesque neighborhood named Frontier emerges along 8th Avenue toward South Shoreline Drive. Pretty boulevards with majestic oaks lining the streets are punctuated with grassy islands separating the traffic to give the place a park-like feel. Streets with the names Monaca, Shawnee, and Mohawk are filled with brick homes built from the late 1920s to the mid-20th century. The Frontier neighborhood is a suburban haven annexed by the city of Erie in strict accordance to the deed of the original property owner, William Scott, a wealthy Gilded Age robber baron who wanted his rural farmland to eventually be laid out as a subdivision to make Erie more beautiful. Patty Bloomstein's home on Columbia Circle hugs a ridge that has a breathtaking view of Lake Erie's Presque Isle Bay. Three classic red wooden Adirondack chairs sit at the property line. Directly below them, the steep drop to the shoreline gives way to Ferncliff Beach and the Erie Yacht Club. On this balmy spring afternoon, sailboats glide in and out of their slips. The breeze is pitch perfect for a cruise on this sheltered part of the shallowest of the Great Lakes. The home Patty shares with her husband Chris and son Max is airy, full of light. The decor is moderate but elegant. Family photos are abundant, and in the living room, her dog naps silently in front of the fireplace. Bloomstein grew up not far from this, Erie's premier neighborhood, and so did her husband. Both their families live within a stone's throw of their house. Except my sister, who lives in Belgium. She is a teacher on the NATO base, Patty explains. Bloomstein is engaging, animated, very funny, and fast. One almost needs to take notes on an index card to keep up with her conversation as she bounces from one observation to another. From the outside, she looks like the picture of health. Her thick, mid-length chestnut hair curves smoothly around her neck, and her skin is luminous, with only a faint hint of makeup, and scant is evidence that she tires easily. The Bloomstein family is comfortable, educated, professional, well-mannered, and suburban through and through. At 55, Patty is a respected civic volunteer, a social worker who put off her career to be a stay-at-home parent, and more recently, a breast cancer survivor. She's active and optimistic, so the casual observer might never suspect it. Bloomstein is exactly the kind of voter who was at the top of Hillary Clinton's persuasion target list during the 2016 campaign. In swing states, such as Pennsylvania, televisions were jammed full of ads aimed squarely at one slice of the electorate, white women with college degrees. The Clinton campaign calculated that this group, which typically tilts Republican but is less conservative than the rest of the GOP's base, would be especially put off by Trump's string of insensitive and crude verbal explosions. Clinton ran an ad called Role Models that seemed to show the perspective of kids watching Trump curse and use inappropriate language from the podium, designed to make their mothers think twice about voting for him. It ran another ad, Mirrors, with teenage girls looking into mirrors as Trump's abusive comments about women's figures play in the audio, including, "A person who's flat-chested is very hard to be a 10. Clinton used one of the three presidential debates to pick a fight over Trump's negative comments shaming a former Miss Universe winner for her weight gain. After that debate, a senior Clinton campaign official told the Washington Post, "We know that white suburban women are critical for both parties, and the lowest hanging fruit for expansion among that group is more likely to be college-educated white women." A poll taken in late September by the Washington Post and ABC News found that Trump trailed among white women overall by 2 points. And that survey was taken 2 weeks before the release of the Access Hollywood backstage tape, in which Trump spoke vulgarly and abusively about his attempts at sexual exploits with a woman who was not his wife. In the wake of that incident, many Republican elected officials, including prominent women, such as Senator Kelly Ayotte, renounced Trump in the strongest of terms. Even Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, never one prone to strong language, called it repugnant. Clinton used that audio in a brutal online ad in the campaign's final week, pairing it with old footage of the much younger Trump saying, "Putting a wife to work is a very dangerous thing," and, "When I come home and dinner's not ready, I go through the roof." Clinton's all-out push to aim her campaign's closing argument at suburban women fell short, if exit polling was accurate. The polls taken by a national news media consortium as voters were leaving their precincts on Election Day found that Trump won white women by 9 points, 11 points better than where he stood in the Washington Post ABC News poll in late September. The exit surveys, which are conducted by interviewing randomly selected voters as they leave polling places, found Clinton winning with white, college-degreed women by 7 points, 51-44, a margin not nearly large enough to offset her 61-34 loss among non-college-educated white women. Clinton's overall showing of 43% with white women was scant improvement over Barack Obama's 2012 performance of 42% of the white female vote, in spite of the fact that she aimed a major share of her campaign's resources at that group. Even if Clinton's campaign did not work, all evidence points to the fact that it almost did. In the crucial presidential swing states, nearly one in five Trump voters say that at some point during the campaign, they were embarrassed to tell their friends or relatives they were voting for him, for fear of disapproval. 61% of these shy Trump voters, so named for the long-observed trend in the United Kingdom of a hidden vote for the stodgy and uncool conservative party, were college-educated, and they were disproportionately female. Among all college-educated white women who voted for Trump, according to Wes Anderson's post-election survey in swing states, 29% reported reluctance to share their support, even with family. In the weeks leading up to Election Day, Blumstein found herself going from watching the news every day to not watching at all. "I just found myself becoming negatively affected by the constant predictions that Trump was going to lose, and by the inferences made by reporters every time they reported on him. The smallest thing became a big negative," she says. Then the biggest negative of all landed on Friday night, October 7th. The Access Hollywood backstage tape was released. By this point, Blumstein had gone from being a supporter of Trump to a campaign volunteer. "It was on a weekend, I went down to the campaign office to make calls and find out if there was anything I could do. When the look on everyone's face told me something was terribly wrong, she says. The other volunteers at the campaign office told her news had been unraveling that a tape existed of Trump bragging in explicit and vulgar terms about growing